Serengeti, an FBI crime scene tech called out. Getty was standing at the rear of the van wearing disposable white coveralls, latex gloves, and blue booties over her shoes. The two rear doors of the van were open, revealing shelves, boxes of supplies, 6 satellite dishes, and stacked rolls of cable. "You're going to want to see this," Getty said. We all went to the rear of the van, which looked spotless. "Kill the lights," she said. The interior lights died. So did the spots brought in to illuminate the search. She picked up a bottle marked Luminol and started spraying it around. Luminol is a compound that glows when it's exposed to certain substances, like the iron in hemoglobin. When someone tries to clean up blood, traces of it are left behind. Spray that area with Luminol, and the chemical glows blue for a brief period. There were a few blood spatters immediately visible on the van floor close to the doors. The more Getty sprayed, the more spatters appeared, until it looked like a starry night had been superimposed on the van's floor, ceiling, and walls. "What the hell is that?" Potter said. The manager had come up behind us. Samson looked at him and said, "Evidence of a slaughter." Chapter 95. The next morning, Samson and I drove to the address of the woman who'd been driving the van the night it was stolen. Lourdes Rodriguez lived in Silver Spring, Maryland, on the 8th floor of a large, mid-priced, brick-faced apartment building. At the locked front door, we buzzed Rodriguez's apartment number, 805, and got no answer. We figured that with an apartment building that big, there might be a live-in superintendent, and we looked out when Arnie Pfeiffer answered our ring and soon buzzed us in. Samson and I entered a foyer featuring 1970s decor that showed the dings and scratches of time and neglect. "Not where I'd be living if I'd inherited a boatload," Samson said. I agreed, thinking that I'd expect a woman in her early 30s with newfound wealth to choose to live in one of the newer, more luxurious apartment buildings in downtown Silver Spring, or... A door to our right opened. A television blared the patter of an announcer for American Ninja Warrior. A nebbishy man in his 60s shuffled out of the apartment wearing a maroon bathrobe over his clothes, slippers, and a blue and white yarmulke on his head. He squinted through round glasses.
"You the cops?"
"You the super?" Samson asked as we showed him our identifications. "Lord of the castle," he said.
"Arnie Pfeiffer, how can I help, detectives?"
"We'd like to go knock on Lourdes Rodriguez's door," I said.
"Why? What's she done?"
"We just want to ask her a few questions about her prior workplace." Pfeiffer hesitated, then said,
"I'll go with you, if you don't mind."
"Not at all," I said.
"Come on then,"
he said, and he shuffled by us, heading to the elevators. Posted on one of the two was a handwritten sign that read, "Out of service." We rode the creaking, shuddering lift to the 8th floor. The doors squealed open, and we stepped out into a musty hallway with dingy rugs. We walked down the hall to apartment 805 and rang the bell. There was no answer. We knocked, but no one came to the door. I was about to suggest we leave business cards with a note asking her to call us, when from inside we heard the high-pitched mewing and cries of a cat that sounded very upset.
"A cat?" Pfeiffer said furiously. "No cats! No dogs! The lease is clear!"
After a glance at me, Samson said, "It's within your rights to remove the cat from your property. We'll help. It's the least we can do for you." The superintendent studied us suspiciously.
"You're not looking to get around a warrant, are you?"
Samson said, "If we wanted to do that, we'd tell you we smelled gas."
"I run electric,"
Pfeiffer said as the cat's cries turned frantic. "Sounds like it's hungry," I said. "We could always call in animal control for suspicion of neglect on Ms. Rodriguez's part. They could get us in." The super didn't like that and grudgingly dug under his robe for a key ring. He found the master key and used it to turn the deadbolt and unlock the door. Pfeiffer pushed the door open. A filthy yellow and orange tabby sprang out and darted between our legs before any of us could grab it. The cat sprinted down the hall, took a sharp right, and disappeared.
"I'm getting too old for this crap," Pfeiffer said with a moan, his palm to his forehead.
I saw he wasn't talking about the cat, but about the apartment. The place was empty and swept clean. Chapter 96. Pfeiffer trudged into the modest one-bedroom apartment, and we followed. When he reached the living area, he gazed around in disbelief.
She never said anything about leaving.
We heard she'd inherited a lot of money, I said.
That right?
The super said, raising one bushy gray eyebrow.
She never mentioned it, but why would she? How long ago?
Few months.
Big money and she lived here for months? Pfeiffer said, incredulous.
What could I say? The man knew his place in the market.
Could we see your copy of her lease? Samson asked.
Why?
He said, suspicious again. I gather you have no forwarding address since she skipped out, but there will be bank and reference information in the lease agreement that might help us figure out where she's gone. Pfeiffer considered that and then nodded. After confirming that Rodriguez had indeed removed all her possessions, we were on our way out when I noticed some newspapers in a brown paper bag behind the door. I picked the bag up, hoping they'd give us an idea of how long she'd been gone. I pulled out a stack of loose newspaper sections and flipped through a few. The sections were all from the Washington Post, several going back a month or more, front pages mostly, with a few metro sections thrown in. I kept looking through the newspapers as we rode down and noticed something that quickly became a troubling pattern. I kept it to myself until Pfeiffer had gone into his apartment and we were alone in the lobby. "We're keeping these papers," I said, slipping them back in the bag.
"Why's that?" Samson asked.
"In almost every section there's a story about Gretchen Lindell or one of the other missing girls."
"So maybe Lourdes Rodriguez had reason to sneak out in the middle of the night?"
"Maybe she did." Pfeiffer emerged from his apartment with a file marked Apartment 805, L. Rodriguez. I flipped the file open, took a glance at the standard rental agreement form, and then zeroed in on a photo of the tenant stapled to the contract.
"Huh,"
I said, seeing Rodriguez in a whole new light. I took a picture of the rental agreement and the photo, then handed the contract back to Pfeiffer.
"That it? I gotta go find that cat."
We thanked the super for his time and left. The second the front door clicked behind us, Samson said,
"What did you see on that lease?"
"My poker face didn't work?"
"I've known you since you were 10.
I pulled up the shot of the picture stapled to the contract. "Lourdes Rodriguez," I said. "I know her by another name." Chapter 97. The ultra-luxury Union Wharf apartment complex on Fells Point was the most expensive place to live in Baltimore, costing five times what Lourdes Rodriguez had been paying at Pfeiffer's. We'd used the bank account and other information on Rodriguez's old lease to track her to her new digs. A small moving van was snarling traffic on South Wolf Street. The front door to one of the apartment buildings was propped open for workmen carrying furniture wrapped in blankets. We followed them inside and up the stairs to 2E. The door was open. Reggae music was playing. The workmen went in, so did we. I trailed Samson past stacks of moving boxes choking the front hallway, hearing a familiar voice saying, "Be careful with that, it was my mother's." We stepped out into a living area with large glass windows that gave a sweeping and dramatic view of Baltimore Harbor. Wearing jeans and a loose-fitting pink jersey, Lourdes Rodriguez paced by the window, watching the workmen move a table into position. She looked puzzled when she saw Samson standing there holding his badge. Then she noticed me. I stepped into the room, said, "You never sent me your new email, Annie." For a second, the love junkie was so shocked, I thought she might faint dead away. Then she croaked, "Dr. Cross, what are you doing here?"
"I could say the same, Annie. Or is it Lourdes?"
She swallowed, looked away.
"Lourdes.
Why'd you use the fake name when you came to see me?" Rodriguez blinked, puffed out her cheeks, and glanced at the workmen who were leaving the room. "Isn't this privileged?"
"Not when it comes to murder, kidnapping, and torture," Samson said.
That threw her.
"What are you talking?"
She looked at me.
"Dr. Cross, I came to you under an alias because of the addiction I told you about. I don't know anything about any torture or murder or kidnapping."
"The van that was stolen from you when you were working for Dish," Samson said. "We ran tests on the interior. Whole lot of blood spatter.
She looked down. Blood spatter? It was stolen. I had nothing to do with that.
Didn't you? I said. The same van was caught on film when two blonde girls from Pennsylvania were taken. Her jaw dropped, and she took a step backward.
Seemed a big coincidence, Sampson said, given that you left behind all those articles about the same missing girls at your old apartment at Mr. Pfeiffer's.
And given that I saw you leaving my office in a car driven by a man posing as Alden Lindell, the father of one of the missing girls, I said. She shook her head as if trying to clear it.
Wait, what? The father of one of the missing girls?
A man who's been claiming to be him. You got into his Nissan Pathfinder right after our one and only session. I saw you.
What is going on, Annie? Lourdes? Whatever your real name is.
She threw up her hands in exasperation. Last time I left your office, I called Uber. They sent some Uber guy. You can check. I'm sure there's a record.
Uber? Was that possible? The fake Alden was an Uber driver?
You call for an Uber car, and usually the one that's closest responds.
Which meant what? That the imposter, whoever he was, had been close by watching my house?
We will check Uber, Sampson said. What about the news articles?
Rodriguez rubbed her neck, didn't look at us, and didn't reply.
It's going to come out sooner or later, I said. Courts go easier on the first person in a conspiracy to flip.
Conspiracy? She said sharply. No, it's nothing like that. Not really.
What the hell does that mean?
Looking flustered now, Rodriguez wrung her hands and then held them up in surrender. Okay, I got caught up in something a long time ago, Dr. Cross, and I'll tell you everything I know, everything. The honest-to-God truth.
Chapter 98. 2 hours and 45 minutes later, Sampson had gotten off I-95 and was driving us north on Front Street, which parallels the freeway and the Delaware River as they pass through Philadelphia. The weather was changing. Dark clouds boiled on the western horizon.
Chalabi sounds like a first-class creep, Sampson said.
He won't be the first to achieve film success that way, I said.
We went over the high points of Rodriguez's confession for the fourth or fifth time. A childhood friend of Lourdes Rodriguez, Casey Chalabi, had always wanted to be a movie director. He ended up making porn films under the name Dirk Wallace, Rodriguez told us. It's all S&M, bondage, the hard stuff. She said Chalabi put aside money from the porn shoots to fund production of a horror film he'd written.
Horror's cheap to film, she said. Casey said you can do them for under $1 million. James Wan did Saw for a little over $500,000, and it made, like, $55 million.
Casey's trying to model himself on Wan.
Rodriguez claimed that even with the porn money, Casey's horror flick was being shot on a shoestring. When he learned she was going to inherit her great uncle's fortune, he was immediately after Rodriguez to help fund his film.
I gave him some, and I didn't even have the inheritance yet, she said. I took it from my savings. $5,000, and then another $5,000. Then Casey wanted the van, my van at Dish. He said even with the money I'd given him, he couldn't afford to buy or rent one, and mine was perfect. He wanted me to just lend it to him for the night.
What'd you say?
I said no. No way. But Casey can be a vindictive a-hole.
Sampson raised his eyebrows.
You saying Chalabi stole your van?
I'd put money on it, and that blood you found inside, was it human?
We don't know yet, I said. It's probably pig's blood. He uses lots of pig's blood in the big slasher scenes in Blade.
I thought about that for several moments. So he steals your van, uses it in a killing scene in his movie. I'm still having trouble seeing how this connects to those newspaper articles we found at Pfeiffer's.
Rodriguez swallowed hard. I haven't spoken with Casey since my van was stolen, but I read his script a long time ago. It's about these four sisters who inherit an abandoned factory in this old Victorian house. Then it's pretty much like every other horror flick you see. Except the sisters, they're all ethereal and blonde.
every one of them, and they get killed, one by one.
Which was enough for us to drive to Philadelphia to talk to Mr. Chalabi face to face. Rodriguez had given us the last address she had for Chalabi. She said she thought it was where he shot the porn movies. We found the address, a rehabbed old school called the Emerson that had been turned into lofts and workspaces down the street from the Theater of Living Arts. Rodriguez couldn't remember the exact name of Chalabi's company, but we found CC Productions listed on a board at the entrance to the Emerson. It was on the second floor, Unit 2, the address Rodriguez had given us. We took the staircase and walked down a long hallway past the open doors of artist studios and the closed doors of others in the arts and entertainment fields. The place smelled nice. There was music playing. It had a good vibe all in all, and that bothered me as we walked up to the closed door of CC Productions. I couldn't see the management letting him shoot porn or slasher flicks on the premises. Samson knocked, turned the knob, and opened the door. I took one look inside and swore to myself. CC Productions was an animation company. There were framed cartoon stills on the wall above the workstation of an Indian American woman in her 20s who looked up and smiled. "Can I help you?" she said. Samson said, "We're looking for Casey Chalabi." "I'm Cassandra Chalabi," she said. "Of course you are," I said, furious. "Sorry to bother you." We shut the door. Samson said, "Con artist. Total pro, pathological liar. How much you want to bet she started making a third move since we left?" "Not a nickel. Lourdes Rodriguez, Annie Cassidy, whatever she calls herself, is in the wind."
Chapter 99. When Samson and I returned to the front door of the arts building, gloom had set in outside, and a chill rain fell on hurried pedestrians bent to the storm.
"We're gonna get soaked," Samson said.
"Run for it," I said. I jerked open the door and hopped out. Rain, driven by a strong north wind, pelted my face and eyes, forcing me to duck my head and throw my forearm across my brow as I ran toward the car, virtually blind. As I was crossing 7th Street, I stepped in a pothole. My right foot and shoe were submerged. My ankle and lower shin hit the edge of the depression, and I stumbled and sprawled in front of a Chrysler Sebring waiting at the light. But that probably saved my life, because as soon as I tripped, I heard a thumping noise and the Sebring's right headlight exploded.
"Shooter!"
Samson shouted. He grabbed me by the back of the jacket, hauled me behind the Sebring, and threw me to the ground just before a second bullet smacked into the grill and penetrated the radiator, which threw steam. The Sebring's driver started screaming in a language I didn't recognize. My shin was screaming in a language I didn't recognize. But I forced myself to dig for my service weapon and badge.
"Where is he?"
I said. Samson said,
"I caught a flash of the first shot, elevated slightly, northwest corner of the intersection and back. Sounded suppressed, too."
I ignored the pain in my leg and got up enough to look over the hood through the teeming rain. The traffic light on one-way South Street had gone yellow. Two cars passed. Their headlights threw glare that dazzled me until the third shot. I saw the flare of it, and then the Sebring's windshield and passenger side window fragmented as the bullet passed through both. I ducked down, hearing the frightened screams from the driver turned petrified.
"Pickup parked on the north side of South Street," I said.
The light turned green on 7th. The hysterical Sebring driver stomped on the gas, but the car bucked, stalled, and belched steam and smoke before dying 10 feet into the intersection. The drivers of several cars behind us spun their tires, trying to get around the Sebring. Other cars began honking frantically. Samson said,
"Pickup's running the red."
In one motion, I stood and had my pistol in my shooting hand over the Sebring's passenger side mirror. I was aiming at the pickup, which was trying to avoid the skidding cars in the intersection. For a moment, I had nothing to shoot at. Then I picked up a shadow. Someone dressed in black standing in profile against the back of the truck cab. He shifted, exposing the sound suppressor on the muzzle of his rifle.
"Gun!"
I said. I fired and missed. The gunman returned fire, but the shot went wide. Samson's shot went wide as well, 2 feet to the gunman's right, shattering the truck's driver's side window. The brakes went on. A Volvo station wagon turning the corner onto South smashed into the truck's rear corner panel, throwing the gunman off his feet. He fell behind the walls of the truck bed. I hobbled after a charging Samson, his gun and badge up to oncoming traffic, and my gut feeling was that something terrible was going to happen unless I kept up with my partner.
Trying to back up, the Volvo almost ran us over. We dodged around it as the pickup's brake lights went off and the truck started to roll again, passing beneath street lamps as it slowly gained speed.
We ran with it, and I caught a glimpse of the driver, a scruffy-faced guy with a tangle of dark hair and bleeding cheeks.
The pickup pulled away. The gunman rose to his knees in the bed and looked at us, grinning. The truck sped up and was gone into a mash of red taillights long before the police sirens started to wail.
"No light on the license plate," Samson said in disgust as we walked through the still pouring rain back to the smoking Sebring. "Probably smashed when it got rear-ended."
"There was enough light on the shooter, though," I said, limping and feeling twisted and toyed with.
He likes to call himself Alden Lindell.
Part 5. All Blondes Must Die. Chapter 100.
At home the next evening, I was on my back with my ankle elevated and iced, watching coverage of the shooting incident on a D.C. station.
"There Detective Cross goes again,"
said Assistant U.S. Attorney Nathan Wills, peering in disgust at the camera from under an umbrella.
"He's not back on the job a week, and already the bullets are flying."
"Those bullets flew my way first," I said, and stabbed the remote until the screen went black. "The brass know that," Bree said, coming out of the kitchen in our great room and setting a cup of coffee on the table beside me.
"Michael's put me on leave," I said, again.
"Department regulations," Bree said, sitting beside me. "Samson's no better off than you."
"Better ankle," I said.
"Well, there's that," Bree said.
We fell into a silence that got longer. I stared at the blank screen, wondering for the 100th time why the man impersonating Alden Lindell was fixated on me. Was he part of the crew that tried to frame me for murder? Picking up where Claude Watkins and Kimiko Binks left off? And what about Lourdes Rodriguez? Was that even her real name?
In the wake of media uproar surrounding the shooting in Philly, Chief Michaels had been in no mood to seek a search warrant for her new apartment, even when we explained that she'd set us up to be assassinated.
"I'm beginning to wonder if this is worth it anymore," I said, looking over at Bree. "Being a cop, I mean."
Cocking her head, frowning, she set her coffee down.
"You're serious?"
"I'm serious enough to know that I want to stay being a psychologist, a counselor, at least part-time," I said. "I enjoy it. It feels right. And matters in a way hunting down bad guys just doesn't anymore, Bree." She gazed at me, blinked.
"You are serious."
"I guess I am. Maybe it's time. They say most people have 5 careers in their lives. Maybe this is how I'm supposed to be the best I can be in the future."
"A higher calling?"
I sighed. "Is that so hard to believe?"
Bree smiled at me, but there was a tinge of sadness in it.
"No, I can understand it.
At least of an ordinary cop who'd seen too much, but you're no ordinary cop, Alex Cross."
"That's debatable. Tell that to the awards and citations you have piled in your attic office. Tell that to all the families of victims you've helped just by being you. Relentless, smart, and professional with a moral compass that is unwavering."
"I'm impulsive," I said. "I get shot at. A lot."
"Because you have the God-given knack of getting close to bad guys and upsetting their plans. You actually do that on a regular basis, Alex. Very, very few detectives can say that."
Before I could reply, Ali pounded through the kitchen and out to us.
"Dad," he said, "I think I've finally found my sport."
Of my 3 children, my youngest might be the brightest, but he is, shall we say, challenged athletically. Ali had tried various sports, basketball, baseball, and even lacrosse, but nothing ever clicked, and he seemed to trip over his own feet a lot.
"I'm hoping your sport's not ice hockey," I said.
"What?"
Ali said, almost indignant.
"No."
"Horse jumping?"
"No, darts."
"Darts.
There's a tournament coming up," he said.
I've been playing a bunch at my friend Charlie's house after school, but I need my own board and a set of good darts if I'm going to have any chance of qualifying.
Feeling a twinge in my ankle, I closed my eyes. I heard Bree say,
"Where's this tournament?"
"At a bar on Capitol Hill," Ollie said.
"A bar?" I said, opening my eyes.
"Technically a tavern. I walk by there all the time after the bus drops me."
"You're not going to a bar or a tavern to play darts."
"It's a $10,000 prize, Dad."
"You're too young to be playing darts where people are drinking alcohol."
"No, I went in and asked. As long as you're with me, they said I can play."
The doorbell rang.
"I'll get it," Bree said.
"Let Ali," I said.
"Can I get the dartboard?"
"Start by getting the door." He hesitated, then ran out.
"Darts?" Bree said, trying to hide her smile. "In a tavern?"
"Nana Mama is going to have a cow," I said, laughing.
"She's going to have two cows. Maybe an entire dairy farm if this becomes a regular thing."
"Darts," I said, and I shook my head at how quickly Ali went from a sharp and analytical adult-like person to a young boy attracted by the next shiny object.
I heard his footsteps pound back to us, and I thought for sure he was going to ask about the darts again.
Instead, he said breathlessly,
"It's Ned and Crazy Cat."
Chapter 101. Keith Rollins' mohawk had been re-dyed flaming red and shellacked to jut out off his head like a jaunty rooster's comb. But the normally upbeat cybercrimes expert looked subdued when he came into the room.
"Dr. Cross, Chief Stone," he said, "I need to show you something, with your permission. I'd like to connect my laptop to your television screen."
"Go ahead," Bree said.
"What's going on?" I asked Mahoney when he came into the room after speaking with Nana and my dad.
"Ned said, Rollins says he knows why Lourdes Rodriguez was so quick and quiet about leaving her old apartment. He started to explain it on the way here, but most of it went right over my head."
"I'll try to dumb it down further, Agent Mahoney," Rollins said, sounding annoyed as he typed on his laptop.
A moment later, the television screen came on, showing a gibberish of coded numbers, letters, and symbols. Rollins scrolled down through the mess until he found what he wanted. He highlighted a sequence in the sea of code.
"That's a time stamp from a few days ago, immediately after Lourdes Rodriguez's name was entered into the FBI's database as part of the ongoing investigation," Rollins typed.
The screen jumped to another coded document and highlighted a new sequence.
He said, "2 seconds after Rodriguez's name goes in, this second timestamp is triggered in a different file, a familiar file. That ingenious, eloquent piece of malware code I found in your computer and then in the FBI database."
Bree said, "You're saying Rodriguez's name triggered the malware?"
"And the malware triggered Rodriguez's swift departure from that apartment. The troubling thing is that I should have seen this sooner, but after that marathon work session I put in to resurrect Timmy Walker's iPhone, I went home and slept for 20 hours, and I woke up with a nasty stomach bug that cost me another day."
Rollins said that he'd finally returned to his lab earlier that morning to see the alert from the code he'd attached to the malware.
"Where did this stuff about Rodriguez go?" Bree asked.
"Through onion routers, of course," Rollins said, typing. "A dozen in all. But I intentionally overrode the malware's code so that every time it passed through the onion, it would send me a ping so I could track it."
The screen jumped to a map of the world with glowing lime green pins denoting onion routers and orange arrow showing the direction of travel after the message cleared the device. From Quantico to India, to China, to the Philippines, to Ecuador, and on, until Rodriguez's name reached Japan.
"That's only 11 routers," Ali said. "You said 12.
"I did indeed," Rollins said, and he typed.
The screen switched to Google Earth, a satellite view of a checkerboard of woods and farmland.
"You're looking at an unincorporated area in southwestern Pennsylvania due east of the Michaux State Forest," he said, then zoomed down on a compound of 3 buildings. The biggest, a mansion, really, was sprawling and sat beside a large pond surrounded by hard woods and pine thickets.
That's a 12,000-square-foot home with carriage house, barn, and personal bass pond, Rawlins said.
But notice, the satellite dish is on the roof. Even for a big place, it's overkill.
And this is where the malware went after Japan, I said. Most definitely. Who owns it? The cybercrimes expert sobered.
Nash Edward Eggers.
You probably never heard of him, but Mr. Eggers is infamous in certain circles. Circles that often disappear into the dark web.
Rawlins described Edgars as a secretive, reclusive, and extremely wealthy computer code writer in his late 30s. At 17, after his freshman year at Cal Poly, Edgars left and became the behind-the-scenes coder for several edgy, successful tech businesses.
That we know for sure, Rawlins said. The dark web stuff is rumor and conjecture. But some very smart people swear Edgars has been developing and operating in the unorganized, encrypted, and untraceable internet for a decade, maybe longer.
I squinted at the screen.
What connects him to Rodriguez?
I don't know exactly.
No photo of him?
A poor one, 7 years old, Rawlins said.
But first, he returned to his typing.
We're lucky this sat view was shot in late winter or early spring, or I wouldn't have noticed them.
Rawlins scrolled down the Google Earth image, taking us past the compound and over the forest. The image stopped where we could look down through the branches of bare hardwood trees. Rawlins put his cursor on a smudge and zoomed in, revealing another structure, a long building with a tin roof. He moved his cursor to a second smudge on the satellite view and magnified it to reveal the lines of a large square.
What is that? I asked.
I believe it's an old foundation with a high stone wall here, similar to the one Gretchen Lindell was put up against during the mock execution.
Jesus, I said, sitting forward. Can we see that photo of Edgar's?
The question seemed to irritate Rawlins, who typed and said, give me a second to find it. But what's critical to understand here is that Edgar's didn't leave Cal Poly to follow Bill Gates and strike out on his own at 17. In fact, Edgars was expelled from Cal Poly at 17, when he was still a juvenile, so the case is sealed.
No idea why? Bree asked.
I know exactly why, he said as the screen changed to a blurry photograph of two men leaving an urban restaurant. One was scruffy, dark-haired, and wore jeans, a Metallica t-shirt and flip-flops. The other man was slightly older with a military haircut and aviator sunglasses. Blurred or not, the picture made my stomach lurch. Rawlins's cursor moved to the scruffy bearded guy.
This is Nash Edgars. The other one's name is Mike Pratt. He's Edgars' bodyguard.
I said, Edgars was driving the pickup in Philadelphia the other night. Pratt was both the shooter and the Alden Lindell impersonator.
Rawlins looked deflated to have some of his thunder stolen from him. But then he recovered and said, here's the kicker from my corner. I hacked into Cal Poly's system and found Edgars' file. He was accused of sexually assaulting three co-eds his freshman year. Every one of them was blonde.
Chapter 102. Clouds of steam billowed from our lips at 4:10 the following morning. It was bitter cold as we huddled in puffy jackets, wool caps, and gloves around a laptop computer, bolted to a steel table inside an FBI special weapons and tactics van, parked in the barnyard of a dairy farmer who lived 2 miles from Nash Edgars and who had nothing good to say about his reclusive neighbor.
Give us the drone feed, Mahoney said into a cell phone.
The screen changed from the sharpness of Google Earth to an opaque gray-green that revealed bare-limbed trees and then the road that led past Edgars' gate.
Thermal images appeared. Two men were guarding the gate, carrying weapons. Flying on, the drone found the mansion, but the screen showed no thermal images of bodies, or much of anything for that matter.
Mahoney said, drone pilot says the place appears heavily insulated, so there might be people inside or not. We'll have to go on the assumption the house is manned and heavily armed.
Smart, I said.
Mahoney said into his cell, fly to that structure out in the woods.
The drone found the building. A thermal sensor revealed 4 faint images of people inside, all lying flat or curled up, located in separate little rooms.
Those could be some of our missing women, Special Agent Batra said.
Easily, Bree said,
and she sipped from a go cup of steaming coffee.
That changes things, Mahoney said. Show me the Google Earth image again.
Rollins switched it back to the satellite image. Mahoney pointed to a rocky knoll on the estate's far north boundary.
This is excellent high ground. We'll put four agents there to cover the back door.
I noticed something in the trees along a creek well to the east of the knoll, but before I could say anything, Rollins switched back to the drone's feed showing more gray-green forest, but no other distinct thermal images.
Thanks for the flyby, Mahoney said into his cell.
Then he ordered four agents to enter the woods at the estate's northeast corner.
He also moved a six-man hostage rescue team, or HRT, into position to get to and storm that building in the woods as soon as possible.
Bree and Sampson would ride with Mahoney and follow a breach team of FBI agents onto the property to arrest Edgars and Pratt.
Alex, you'll be with Batra and Rollins in a follow car, where you'll remain until the clear is given, Mahoney said.
Before I could protest, Bree said, Be practical, Alex. With your ankle like that, you won't be much help if things go south.
It's not that bad, really, I said. I'm not even on crutches, but I hear you.
We'll give you a radio, Mahoney said. For once, you'll have to just listen to the action.
Chapter 103. As I limped into the back seat of Agent Batra's black Chevy Tahoe, I had to admit I was feeling guilty for wanting to be part of the raiding party and hostage rescue attempt. The evening before, I'd been telling Bree that I wanted to get out of police work, away from dangerous moments like these, when the adrenaline starts to drip and your senses get super sharp and super clear. But as I shut the door and Batra started the engine, I knew a part of me could never leave the police game. Not entirely. Being a psychologist had its own deep and fruitful rewards, but it could never replace the rush of catching bad guys, ending their dark work, and seeing them get just punishment.
Let's roll, Mahoney said. I heard his voice over the radio and the light headset they'd given me.
Isn't this exciting, Dr. Cross?
Crazy Cat Rollins said, looking over the front seat at me as Batra put on her headlights and followed Mahoney's Tahoe onto a rural route heading east.
The trick is not to get too excited, I said. You have to keep your head.
Oh, of course, he said, slightly crestfallen.
I guess I'm just looking forward to seeing Nash Edgars in handcuffs and telling him that I beat him.
Do you ever feel that way?
From time to time, sure, I said.
Right now?
Right now, I look forward to seeing those women safe and sound.
Over my headset, Mahoney said, Half a mile out. HRT, you are go. Breaching team, you are go. The acknowledgements came back fast, and in my mind, I was seeing the rescue team flipping on their thermal imaging goggles, surging into the woods, and angling through the forest toward the shed and four of the missing women. We came over a rise in the road and saw a huge black six-wheel drive armored FBI truck roll to the gate. I expected the guards to immediately stand down, but instead, there were flashes from behind the gate and reports of gunfire over the radio.
Take it down, Mahoney said.
The big armored rig backed up and then sped at the steel gate and blew it off its hinges. Agents inside the truck fired from portals at the guards, who retreated up the hill into the trees toward the compound. Mahoney followed the armored truck, driving across the down gate with us trailing.
HRT, Mahoney said. 200 yards out, Sack, came the reply. No visuals on the shed yet, but you have lights going on up the hill.
The breaching rig sped up on that news, disappeared around a curve in the long serpentine driveway. By the time we reached the edge of the compound, spotlights were blazing on the courtyard between the main house, the carriage house, and the barn. 10 FBI agents in full SWAT gear poured out of the armored vehicle, divided into teams of two, and fanned out toward the mansion, a modern building made of stone, redwood, and glass. The doors of the carriage house at the far side of the yard were up. The interior wasn't lit, but there was enough light from the exterior spotlights to reveal a white Range Rover and a black pickup truck in the first two bays and several ATVs and dirt bikes in the third. Black pickup truck, I thought. Bet it has a window with a bullet hole or two in it. In front of us, Mahoney got out of the Tahoe. Caught in Batra's headlights, he blinked, held up a hand, and signaled for her to shut them off. Bree and Sampson got out.
The radio chatter from the raiding team and the HRT forces started coming nonstop. I got whining feedback in my headset for a moment. Four agents went to the front door using a battering ram to break it open and then vanished inside. In the woods to our north, the HRT unit had the plywood-faced building surrounded. Thermals showed the four people were still inside, still lying flat or curled up. That didn't seem right to me. They should have been sitting or standing. But maybe they hadn't heard the gunfire. Or maybe they were restrained.
HRT, go in and get them out, Mahoney said over my headset. Now! Lower front hall, clear, said an agent inside the house. Walk out basement, clear, said another.
Where is he? Rollins said from the front seat of Batra's car.
Don't tell me Edgar's isn't here!
Even with the windows up, even with the heater going and the radio chatter in our ears, we all heard the first explosion. Chapter 104.
HRT agent down, the rescue commander said. Repeat, HRT agent down. The place is booby-trapped.
Back out and contain, Mahoney said.
How bad?
We need lifelight ASAP. Calling now.
On the radio, the search commander inside Edgar's mansion said,
Watch for booby traps, gentlemen.
Kitchen clear, said another.
Home theater clear, said a third.
All first floor closets and bathrooms clear, said a fourth.
First floor cleared in full, the commander said.
Bree and Samson left Mahoney and started toward the mansion. I got anxious, felt claustrophobic, and opened the car door.
You're to remain in the car, Dr. Cross, Batra said.
I'm going to stand outside.
I got out and shut the door. My wife and my partner entered Edgar's house with the FBI agents inside already moving to clear the second story. Mahoney told the HRT commander that life flight was 11 minutes out, and then he headed inside as well. I caught some of the communications between the hostage rescue commander and the incoming life flight medic. The agent had opened a door to the building and triggered a small explosive. He had shrapnel in his right thigh and a severed femoral artery. They'd applied direct pressure to the wound so he wouldn't bleed out and were preparing to move him from the woods to the county road for pickup.
Roger that, the medic replied. We are 7 minutes out.
An agent in the house said,
Second floor landing and hallway, clear.
All bedrooms cleared, another said.
Place is empty, Cap.
A high-pitched tone screeched through the headset, so loud I thought my eardrums would burst. I tore the headset off, stuck it in my pocket. The dark second floor windows facing the courtyard suddenly flashed as automatic weapon fire broke out inside the house. Two guns, three, maybe more. I took several limping steps toward the courtyard and the mansion, wanting to see Bree, Samson, and Mahoney retreat out the front door. But they didn't, and the shooting went on in bursts and waves. And,
Dr. Cross,
Agent Batra yelled behind me. I ignored her, pulled toward the violence, wanting to end it. But the gunfire stopped as I passed Mahoney's Tahoe and entered the courtyard. I caught a flicker of motion in the third bay of the carriage house just before a second bomb exploded, much closer, on the other side of the mansion. At the blast, the spotlights flickered and died. The shooting stopped too. Then I heard a noise I'll never forget. Shrill, primitive, and terrified, coming from the carriage house. I pulled out my weapon and flashlight and hobbled fast in that direction as something large and boxy tore out of the third bay. I got my flashlight beam on it as it was leaving the courtyard for the woods. A red and black side-by-side Honda Pioneer 1000 utility vehicle. I caught only a glimpse of the driver and the front seat passenger before it disappeared. But the blonde teen in the bed, blindfolded, gagged, and hogtied, was plain as day. Gretchen Lindell was writhing and trying to scream, and then she was gone.
Batra!
I yelled, flashing the light around and seeing a Kawasaki ATV in the third bay.
Batra!
The shooting started again inside, drowning my second cry. Ignoring the pain shrieking in my ankle, I hobbled to the ATV, yanking the radio from my pocket and tearing free the headset cord, figuring to stop the feedback. But it was worse, and I had to turn the squelch almost off. My flashlight found the ATV ignition, but with no key in it. I lifted the seat, revealing a storage for helmets, and located the key. I straddled the seat, looked at the controls, turned on the headlights, and started the engine. I roared out of the garage, praying Batra could see me, turned onto the two-track lane that went from the compound to the woods, and accelerated. Chapter 105. Bree, Samson, and Mahoney had gone into a large, open, and vaulted space on the main level of the mansion to wait while the upper floors were cleared. The room contained Edgar's state-of-the-art kitchen, a rustic dining area, and several leather couches set before a massive stone fireplace that was flanked by built-in wooden cabinets and shelves crammed with books. Samson said, "Place looks spick and span." Mahoney nodded, ready for that Architectural Digest photographer. Their radios crackled. "Second floor landing and hallway clear. All bedrooms cleared. Place is empty, Cap." Empty? That felt wrong to Bree. She'd been on edge since hearing the bomb explode in the distance. Why booby-trap the outer building and not... A piercing whine went off in her earbud. The worst feedback ever, and she tore it out. Samson did the same. Across the room, Mahoney threw his down too. "What the hell is..." Automatic weapons began to bark and rattle upstairs. Bree instinctively dived behind the kitchen counter with Samson right beside her. The shooting stopped, leaving them shaken and going for their guns. "Agents down!" someone shouted upstairs. "Arthur and Boggs, bedroom 5, far east end of upper hallway!" The search commander at the bottom of the stairs bellowed back over the shooting. "How many? I thought the place was cleared!" "It was, Cap. Shooters must have been..." An explosion outside shook the house. The lights died. "It's an ambush!" Mahoney yelled from over by the couches. "They're jamming our radios and cells! Bree, take Samson and get out of here! Establish communication with..." Bree was about to turn on her flashlight when sound-suppressed automatic weapons lit up. She covered her head as slugs ripped into granite countertops, splintered cabinets, and shattered dishes. The bullets moved left to right, and then right to left, punching holes in the stainless steel appliances, 10, maybe 15 shots in all, raining debris down on Bree and Samson before stopping. Bree shook from fear and adrenaline. Smelling the burned gunpowder, she felt nauseated, but her mind whirled. Where was the shooter? Where had he hidden? Those cabinets weren't big enough to hide a grown man, were they? She felt a tug on her leg. "Chief," Samson whispered. "You okay?" "Fine. Where's the shooter?" "Hit," Mahoney croaked. The fear fled her. Bree flicked on her flashlight and belly crawled across the kitchen tiles calling. "How bad, Ned?" Mahoney gasped. "Gut, you tell me." Somewhere a generator coughed and hummed. Dim light returned. Agents upstairs were shouting, but Bree ignored them. "Where's the shooter, Ned?" she called louder. "Behind me, cabinets." Bree turned her flashlight off, inched forward, and peered around the bottom corner of the kitchen cabinets. She could see well enough to tell Mahoney was sitting upright on the floor by one of the leather couches, but there was no sign of the shooter. "We have to get him out, Chief," Samson said behind her. "Now!" "Not until I know where that shooter is. I won't get us all killed." She thumbed on her flashlight again, peeked around the corner, and let the beam play over Mahoney about 40 feet away. He was hunched over and squinting. Bree focused on the large patch of dark blood showing on his white shirt just below his armored vest. Low liver hit, she thought, and fought to swallow down the panic creeping in the back of her throat. They did have to get him out fast. But the shooter! Bree shifted her light toward the stone fireplace and the cabinets and shelves to either side. The beam flickered over doors far too small for a child, much less a man, and then over rows of books before stopping cold on a small open cabinet. "Jesus Christ," she whispered. Chapter 106. The ATV was equipped with a heavy-duty muffler, so the engine barely made any noise as I drove on the two-track deeper and deeper into the estate. Edgar's side-by-side was no more than 3 or 4 minutes in front of me. I couldn't see tracks in the frozen mud, but the leaves were broken and shiny where it had passed. Snowflakes hit my face. With my free hand, I tugged out the radio and turned it up. There was no longer screeching coming over it, just a dense hiss. "This is Alex Cross," I said. "Copy?" Out of the static, I heard clicking and fragments of an unfamiliar voice. I turned it off, stuffed it back in my coat,
Tried my cell. No service.
The snow flurries turned to thick, heavy flakes.
They're going to get away, I thought. The sadistic bastards are going to get away. There was an intersection ahead and I stopped. The snow covered the leaves, making it impossible for me to say which way Edgris had taken Gretchen Lindell. I tried to recall the satellite view of the property. The shed and the wounded HRT agent were somewhere to my left.
The knoll at the rear of the property, where Mahoney had sent four agents, was somewhere straight ahead of me.
That unidentified smudge on the satellite picture was down the right fork in the trail. I went with my instincts, twisted the ATV throttle, and went right. The snow slapped my face, got in my eyes, and forced me to drive at a crawl. 10 minutes later, the snow squall ended as abruptly as it had started. I rolled downhill to a wide, shallow, iced-over creek, seeing where Edgar's machine had broken up the ice. My instincts were dead on. I drove across the creek, noticing the sky brightening in the east. How far ahead were they? Were those four people back in that booby-trapped building all dead? The HRT guy said they hadn't moved when the booby trap went off. Or was Edgar's taking Gretchen to where he had the other blonde stashed? 100 yards beyond the creek crossing, I lost the tracks and drove on through virgin snow to a turnabout walled in by pines, a dead end. But Edgar's had come this way, I was positive. That ice had absolutely been freshly broken, and those tracks. I drove back, shining the headlights on the crossing, seeing ice covering the creek upstream. I used my flashlight to look downstream. The ice there had been broken up to where the stream disappeared beneath a steep embankment, 8, maybe 10 feet high, and covered with green and tan vegetation frosted with new snow. Where the hell had they gone? I couldn't imagine any machine climbing straight up the side of that wall of... I looked closer at the embankment. Green plants. That was impossible. The leaves had fallen. The ferns were dead. I drove into the creek and rolled slowly to the embankment, headlights on and my flashlight playing around. Even through the frosting of snow, I could see I hadn't been looking at plants, but at thin strips of dull green, gray, and brown cloth, thousands of pieces sewn into a huge swath of camouflage fabric that hung from a stout length of black metal bolted into the rocks above me. I grabbed the radio again and turned it on. The static was weaker. I triggered the transmit button, said, "This is Alex Cross, come back." Almost immediately, a garbled, oddly familiar voice answered. "Batra?" I said. The voice replied, but I couldn't understand a word. I said, "Repeat, this is Alex Cross. I'm in pursuit of Edgar's, who has Gretchen Lindell. I'm somewhere in the northeast quadrant of the estate." The voice came back even more garbled. I almost stuffed the radio in my pocket, but then had a moment of inspiration and said, "If you can hear me, track me by Find My iPhone." I put away the radio that time, traded it for my service weapon. Staring at the camouflage curtain, I hesitated, anxious about what might be waiting on the other side. I killed the headlights, teased the throttle. The bumper touched the fabric and then ripped apart the Velcro that had been keeping it closed. I held my pistol in my left hand, rested the barrel on the handlebar, eased off the safety, gave the throttle more gas, and went through into darkness. Chapter 107. Bree gaped at the smoking Uzi machine pistol mounted on a thin metal post inside the open cabinet. A long banana clip hung below the gun, too big for just 10 or 15 shots. Mahoney coughed and shifted. The gun pivoted his way, and she saw the thin scarlet line of the laser sight fixed to its barrel pass 6 inches over the wounded agent's head. It stopped.
"What the hell's going on?" Samson whispered, crawling up beside her.
She pulled back, said, "Remote control Uzis, unless..." Bree peeked around the corner again, flashed the light at the machine pistol and the cabinet, looking for a camera. Mahoney groaned and shifted, and the couch moved, hitting a table behind it. The lamp on the table wobbled. The Uzi opened up again. That same left to right, right to left spray of bullets. It cut the lamp in half.
and then the gunfire continued on toward the kitchen.
Bree looked up after the shooting stopped, saw that the slugs had hit some of the same things they'd hit during the first barrage.
No, she took that back. They had ripped into the exact same things at the exact same height.
No one's operating that gun, Ned, Bree shouted. I think there's a motion detector involved. See it?
No, he grunted, sounding weaker. An agent yelled down from upstairs that he had to move his wounded men.
The whole place is booby-trapped, Samson yelled. Hold your position.
One's critical. He'll die if we don't move him.
You'll all die if you come down those stairs, Bree shouted as she wriggled back past Samson and crawled to a low line of untouched cabinets next to the stainless steel stove. She looked in three cabinets before she finally found the items she wanted. She grabbed them and scooted back to Samson.
What's with the cookie sheets? He asked.
Motion, Bree said. Then she called out,
Ned, if you can, get down.
She flung one of the cookie sheets over the counter that separated the kitchen from the living area.
The Uzi lit up, rattling bullets left to right, right to left again.
She threw another cookie sheet and then a third before the action of the machine pistol locked open, the breech and barrel smoking hot. She stood up cautiously, saw Ned lying on his side by the couch. His eyes were open but glassy, and his breathing looked shallow.
We're clear,
she shouted to the FBI agents upstairs as she ran to Mahoney. Get your men out! Kneeling by Alex's old FBI partner, Bree refused to cry.
You with me, Ned? Talk to me.
Mahoney nodded and blinked.
Gut shot. I can see that.
Samson came up behind her.
We've got to get him to a hospital, and the jamming's still going on.
Help me get him up, Bree said.
They lifted Ned to his feet. Mahoney passed out from the pain, becoming dead weight. And Samson got him up on his shoulders in a fireman's carry. Bree ran in front of him to the front door and stepped out into the falling snow, shouting,
Alex! Agent Batra!
A flashlight went on. Keith Rollins called timidly.
Just me, Chief Stone!
Samson came out the door with Mahoney over his shoulder. The snow fell in big flakes and coated the pavers as they hustled across the courtyard to the Tahoe Mahoney had driven into the estate. Rollins stood outside it, looking as bedraggled as a cat in the rain.
Drop the rear back seats, would you?
Samson said. Seeming grateful to have something to do, Rollins sprang into action, saying,
The jamming system is remarkable.
We know, Bree said impatiently. Where's Batra's car?
When the jamming started and then all the shooting, she decided to drive out, try to call for reinforcements.
Good,
Bree said as Samson put Mahoney in the back of the Tahoe.
Where's...
Don't leave yet,
an FBI agent yelled down in the courtyard. He carried a badly wounded man. They'd gotten blood clotting agent into a chest wound, but his breathing was ragged and harsh.
Get him in, Bree said, and the next one.
I'll drive,
Samson said, going through Mahoney's coat pockets and finding the keys. Everything was moving fast, and Bree was still in semi-shock from the ambush. So it was not until she saw Samson throw the Tahoe in reverse and fishtail back down Edgar's long driveway that she realized the snow had stopped. She felt confused and overwhelmingly tired. She looked up at the sky, saw the clouds parting and a shaft of moonlight shining through, making the frosted courtyard look like a movie fantasy.
Did Alex go with Agent Batra? She asked Rollins.
No.
She turned to look at him.
What? Where is...
Bree felt the ground tremble. The muted explosion sounded like it had come from deep inside the mansion.
What was that?
Rollins said, backing away.
I don't know, she said. Where is Alex?
Dr. Cross? He...
A second, much louder explosion cut him off. It lit up one of the second-story bedrooms like aluminum in the sun, blew out the windows, and ignited a fierce blaze. Yellow, orange, and ruby flames billowed out of the mansion and licked at the shake shingle roof. Bree moved back fast, feeling dread grow in her stomach.
Where's Alex, Rollins? She shouted. Where's my husband?
Chapter 108. The heavy camouflage curtains flapped shut behind me. My eyes adjusted. I was in a storm drain culvert, a good 10 feet in diameter. Either the potential existed for extreme flash flooding in the creek, or Edgar's had put the culvert in place as an escape route. I was betting that the smudge I'd seen on the satellite view was dirt.